And with our special guest tonight, John Lash, his website is linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. Go ahead, take a look at some of the things he's been working on. This is an incredible story, and we'll be back with him now as we talk about the 9 theories, categories of extraterrestrial contact. Get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. John, I've got to tell you, too, you've got a wealth of knowledge.
Well, thank you.
Really appreciate it. Now, that you've got these 9 theories or categories, you say, mm-hmm. of extraterrestrial contact. Mm-hmm. Let's go through each one. Take the entire hour for that. We'll take phone calls with you next hour.
Excellent.
And let's get a take on your opinion on these various aspects. Number one, you call the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Tell me about that.
Right. Well, that I believe that is the name that is in use. It's not something I invented, but I found it in one of the current books on UFOs. And that is the one, probably, this is the theory that most of your listeners will be familiar with, and the one that gets a great deal of discussion on the airwaves in the United States. The essence of this theory is that there are aliens from a technologically advanced civilization who had made contact with the U.S. government and probably other governments in the world in 1947, if not a little earlier. And at that time, so this theory goes, these alien ET types cut a deal with the government offering to give their advanced technology in exchange for the right to experiment on the population.
Nice trade, right?
Yeah, including both animals and people. So what proceeds then from this theory are the cattle mutilation phenomena, CIA mind control conspiracies, and all of the stuff which you frequently talk about, and Art Bell also frequently talks about, regarding a cover-up of government knowledge of UFOs. We're all very, very aware that that is more than a likelihood. And there are two ways to, as we go through each of these 9 theories or categories, there are two ways to evaluate each one of them. One is, and we can talk about the authors or the main proponents of that theory.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, we can consider, well, what actually is the evidence that supports this
theory? Okay, sure. And why cut a deal? Why not just do it? I mean, how can we stop them?
Well, this is, of course, a huge question, and the notion that such an important event in the evolution of humanity, the contact with another species, would be covered up and controlled by government agencies is more terrifying than the idea of contact itself, you
That's
know?
That's true.
I mean, most people, I think, who have considered and reflected on this hypothesis are aware that the greatest danger may come from our own government and rather than from the aliens who contacted the government. How to break through this? Well, do just what you do so frequently. Allow people to speak their minds, allow the witnesses to come forth, and get as much of the evidence as we can out there in the public domain. I mean, that is the one thing that is the best weapon against a conspiracy of silence in the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
Some of those proponents that you talk about, we know, Timothy Good, David
right.
Icke, George
Icke,
Andrews,
yeah.
and then
right.
David Jacobs, of course, truly believes that there's something threatening and sinister going on here.
Well, yeah, it's interesting to see how the hypothesis has somewhat evolved. I mean, I recognize sort of two main aspects of the extraterrestrial hypothesis. One is, of course, the government CIA connection, cover-up, underground bases, and so forth. The other one is the question of an interbreeding program, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's one thing to say, and it's pretty sinister and scary to say that a covert government made an agreement with aliens to allow them to experiment on our species. Then Jacobs, of course, goes even further and says, well, it's not just experimentation. They're not just giving us medical exams, you know, to find out how we work. They actually have a very extensive interbreeding program, the object of which is to produce some sort of hybrid entity.
And what we don't know is whether it's to take back to their own planet for some reason, or if they plan on having these hybrids take over this planet.
Well, very interesting question. Now, as you know, within this particular category, there are just hundreds of variations of and hundreds of kinds of speculation, one of which is that this species, which has come here in 47, possibly crashed at Roswell and so forth, is a dying species. I'm sure you're familiar with this idea that they are somehow in their own evolution on the down curve, and that possibly by interbreeding with us or genetically tapping into our gene base, our genome, they hope to save themselves. That's one possibility. If that were the case, then they wouldn't have the intention of coming in and replacing us in our own habitat.
Then using that old Twilight Zone movie to serve man, maybe they're using us as feed. You never know.
You never know. It's very, very spooky. In fact, we're starting here of these nine categories with the one that is not only the most well-known in terms of the American public, but also the one which has been reflected in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's been reflected in the science fiction medium for a long time, and usually with rather sinister overtones.
The second one is called the Benevolent Hypothesis, what you call Space Brothers. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, that's Adamski. That's really where it started. I mean, we have to go back to 47 again, and this remarkable coincidence. You know, George, I call it a triangulation.
Yeah.
Just think, the UFO phenomenon, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is a UFO, they were a UFO cult, a contact cult, and the Nag Hammadi, which was an expose of the contact cult, all came to light in that fantastic summer.
That's true.
And if we go back to that time, and we go back to the first contactees like George Adamski and so forth, you'll remember that in the beginning it was implied that they were space brothers. They were the tall blondes from Venus, and they really had come here neither to interbreed, neither to perform obscure experiments with us or with animals, but to warn us and help us. So you see, the Space Brothers, or Benevolent Hypothesis, as I call it, does stand apart from the extraterrestrial hypothesis, which tends to emphasize a sinister program.
Well, nice way to trick people, though. Befriend them first.
Well, there you go. That's very possible that that could be the case, and in that way the two categories would kind of merge. But they're very different in tone. As you know, if you go back and you read that original material, it was kind of euphoric. It was like, wow, we've finally been contacted by someone from outside our world, and they want to help us. They want to warn us about atomic energy. They want to warn us about the pollution of the environment. To tell you the truth, I do find that a little bit suspicious, and I'll tell you why. Because, as a matter of fact, in the late 40s and early 50s, when these initial contactees published their books, we were aware of those dangers, and we didn't need someone from outer space to tell us that we had the ability to destroy ourselves.
We needed them to fix it, not to tell us about it.
That's right. And so that makes me a little bit suspicious about the Space Brother hypothesis.
I think that's a trick.
I do, too. I do, too. And it hasn't panned out very well. I will point out, by the way, in just looking here at my notes, and want to tell your listeners that if they go to metahistory.org, I have posted this document we're reading from on the site. They're welcome to print it out and look at it and make notes on it or whatever. I noted in Category 2, the Space Brothers hypothesis, that the earliest prototype of it probably comes from Madame Blavatsky, who founded the Theosophy movement in the late 19th century. And she had a theory. She wrote a lot about Atlantis and Lemuria.
Right.
And she had a theory about these beings she called the Lords of the Flame. And they were Venusians, and they came from the planet Venus at some remote time in the past and planted into the human mind the seed of a higher intelligence or a higher evolution. And that prototype, I'm a mythologist, remember, so I deal with these various myths and stories. That story seems to be, although it's been largely forgotten these days, seems to be the story that seeded or originated the Space Brothers hypothesis.
What do you think of George Adamski's truly dramatic statements about his visitations?
Well, you know, we all scratch our heads over Adamski, and I guess we always will, you know, because he was the first one that came out. My impression of Adamski, and I try to be as fair as I can, because these are all human beings, you know, and they're all witnessing to their experience in some way or another, you know. But my sense of Adamski is he's a little too close to 50 science fiction for me.
Yeah, I used to think he was a little off kilter myself.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look into his background, he used to have a hamburger stand at the Mount Palomar Observatory.
Sure.
And certainly as he was serving up hamburgers, he was talking to a lot of people about UFO sightings and everything, because that was at the observatory where they were watching the sky. And I tend to feel that Adamski really, at the end of the day, boils down to a kind of 50s sci-fi fantasy.
Maybe just a good salesperson.
Maybe so. He certainly was. He certainly was a good salesperson. That's known.
All right. Your next category is the Sumerian File, which, of course, brings in Zechariah Sitchin, right?
Right. Sitchin is the main proponent of that, as you noted. And the Sumerian File contains these rare clay tablets, considered to be the oldest written documents on Earth. And they present what I call the Anunnaki myth. And the Anunnaki, meaning those who descended from heaven to earth, are the principal characters in Sitchin's hypothesis.
Because he truly believes they're the ones who basically seeded us, genetically altered us, made us.
Indeed. He uses not only the written cuneiform tablets, but he uses what are called these cylinder seal images. They're very tiny images, actually. Some of them are hardly larger than a good-sized postage stamp, but they show some quite remarkable things. And I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with Sitchin, and it's quite convincing the way that he describes or explains what he thinks is happening in these cylinder seals. For instance, where you see a little child with a kind of pigtail coming out of its head, out of the back of its head, sitting on the lap of a humanoid-type creature, with these laboratory vials standing around.
Yes.
And this, he claims, was Ninhursag, who was the midwife of the Anunnaki people who genetically grafted the Anunnaki genes onto the genes of the people that they already found here. So they didn't bring the human race here. They found, presumably, according to Sitchin, a kind of ape-like race, and they grafted their genes onto this race, and therefore we have these huge brains.
Do the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Nag Hammadi ever make reference to an extra planet in the solar system, as Sitchin presents in his theories about Nibiru?
No, they don't. And I've also tried to be very fair and sober and even-minded in evaluating Sitchin. And I must say that there are two huge holes in this third category of the Sitchin hypothesis. One huge hole is his Nibiru lost planet thesis just doesn't seem to pan out. I mean, maybe you have come across someone.
No, I've interviewed a number of astronomers, John. All of them say that they don't believe there's this extra planet like this in the solar system. However, they do say, you know, it's possible, we just haven't found it yet. And I talk about this elliptical orbit of 3,600 years.
Right.
And I'd love to get better coordinates and maybe get it to these astronomers to see if they can try to pinpoint where it could be. What fascinates me, though, about this theory, number three, is that They are beginning to find other planets now that they claim to be in our solar system, one now beyond Pluto. And, you know, who's to say that, you know, it's not possible that there is one out there?
Well, the problem is that 3,600 years, I agree with you, and what supports the probability that this could be so is the fact that we know there are trans-Plutonian planets, and we know that they would have erratic orbits, and there's also the possibility that this is a comet-like planet. And because that's the way comets behave, they have very elliptical orbits, and they go way, way out, and then they come in, so they have a very long period. The problem is that 3,600 years ago is not that long ago, and there is no record in history of this planet, as far as I know, having appeared in our solar system during that time.
Other than through these Sumerian tablets, right?
Well, I can't read the Sumerian tablets, but what I know of them, I don't find explicit reference to the behavior of this planet. I mean, that's where Sitchin gets a little dodgy for me. He's fantastic on most of his scholarship,
sure,
as you know.
Well, and Michael Heiser punches holes through him too.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an incredible theory, and it does make you think.
Well, while we're just taking one last look at him, and before we move on to the next one, I want to point out that I think the Nag Hammadi materials from Egypt have something to say about the Sitchin thesis, because what they say is that, yes, there are these extraterrestrials, these archons, as they're called, but they do not come from an erratic planet. They belong to the part of the planetary system apart from the Earth. They are inherent to our planetary system. So that's a variation on what Sitchin is saying.
Sure. Category 4, biblical mm-hmm. ufology.
Right. Biblical ufology is just a term that I use for all the theories that treat the materials of the Old and New Testament and look at the Bible and find in the Bible evidence of extraterrestrial contact. For instance, the visions of Ezekiel is the most cited example. Almost everyone uses this.
And that's a great story.
Right. And it does seem to be describing some kind of technological entity, some kind of craft, some kind of hardware. The encounter with Jacob, who wrestled with an angel, well, was this a UFO abduction? The angel Gabriel, who announced the birth of Jesus to Mary, was this a UFO or an alien intervention? And finally, also, we should throw into that category the experience of Paul.
Mm-hmm.
At Damascus,
yes,
has been widely considered to have been perhaps a close encounter in which Paul actually ran into a luminous being of a non-human kind.
Wasn't he once Saul, a butcher, and then a butcher of people, and then he changed?
Well, he was a bounty hunter, if you want to use the exact term, George.
Really?
He was a bounty hunter for the Romans, and the remarkable thing is that Paul figures very strongly in the Dead Sea Scrolls, because when you read in the existing Bible, in the New Testament, in the Acts, we're told that Paul was sent to Damascus with certain papers, and he was sent as a bounty hunter to go and find a group of people who were causing trouble to the Roman authorities. The group of people that he was actually looking for in Damascus was a cell, an outpost of the Dead Sea sect, because they had a number of outposts in the wilderness, and it is known that they not only had an outpost in the caves by the Dead Sea, but they had a major outpost or cell in Damascus. And to the Romans, if we could put it in context of today, to the Romans, this apocalyptic group in Damascus would have been considered like a terrorist.
Sure,
cell.
Very dangerous. Stay with us, John. We'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to open up the phone lines next hour, give you an opportunity to talk with John Lash about these many theories and things you're hearing. We'll be back. We'll continue finishing the 9 various categories of extraterrestrial contact in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. The next category, John, fascinating, called the mind control hypothesis. Please explain that one.
Well, that gets into the area of a rather different view of the ET UFO phenomena, and that is more of a psychological analysis. Is it all just something that is not necessarily just happening in our minds, but originates in our minds, and then in some way being projected into a physical reality? Now, probably the first person, the earliest example of the mind-controlled or psychological hypothesis would be the famous psychologist C.G. Jung, who wrote a small booklet on UFOs, I think back in the 50s, in which he proposed that they were, in his language, projections of the collective unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And taking off from Jung, there were then several generations of, a couple of generations of writers, but by far the most well-known, and in my opinion, the outstanding example of this category is Jacques Vallée.
Sure, brilliant, yeah. Brilliant person.
Messengers of Deception is absolutely a superb book, and his trilogy as well. So he called, Vallée did not deny the evidence. In fact, as you know, he started working with Alan Hynek. He was the protege.
Yeah, he was a hardware believer.
Very right. Much so. He was a computer programmer, and so he worked with hardware, and he believed in hardware sightings. But as time went by, and after he went on his own, after working with Hynek, who coined the phrase close encounters, Vallée began to look more and more into the spiritual and psychological dimension, and of course, I believe, came up with a very brilliant analysis. Someone who also belongs in this category is John Keel.
Mr. Mothman. Huh?
Right, Mr. Mothman Prophecies. And there's an excellent book called The Demonic Reality by Patrick Harper, which more or less follows the Jungian viewpoint. So this is a very intellectually sophisticated approach to UFOs, and it assumes, as I say in my notes here, that the phenomena is real, but not exactly in the sense that we may think it is real. And what this hypothesis tells us is that if we seek to understand alien entities and UFO phenomena, we must do it through understanding our own minds more deeply.
You know, I have kicked this specific one around for a long time, the mind control mm-hmm. hypothesis. There's a part of me, John, that truly wants to believe that these extraterrestrials and these visitations are physical, that they are indeed coming from another planet, that we are not alone in the solar system, as the old Walter Sullivan, the New York Times science writer of the time, once wrote. I want to believe that. But then there's this other part of me that can believe the theories of Jacques Vallée, that indeed these are manifestations of our mind.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the way they appear and disappear, and the fact that so many physicists now are beginning to believe in the multiverse and more universes than just one, that's entirely possible now. But the romantic thought of me, right, the UFOs, I want them to be physical. I want aliens to be in the craft looking down at us.
Right, right. But do you want those aliens to be your relatives, and do you want them to live in your mind?
Yeah, exactly. Number six in your category theory list is called visionary theories. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I kind of put this in, you might put the label of New Age on this. This is a kind of a loose category, George, that refers really to...
It's a catch-all.
Channeled materials, such as, you know, the Barbara, what's her name, Barbara Maciniak, the Prism of Lyra, the Only Planet of Choice. This is a vast amount of channeled material that has been brought in by people who claim that they're in contact with beings from the Pleiades and so forth. And the nature of this category is that it doesn't concentrate so much. It claims that the entities, for instance, the Palladians, have hardware, of course, but it doesn't concentrate so much on that. It concentrates more on kind of a vast cosmic story. You know,
mm-hmm.
there are aliens out there from Orion, and perhaps they're more warlike, and they're fighting with the Pleiadians, who are peace-like, and somehow we've got caught in the crossfire between the two of them. So they're very elaborate scenarios. But the problem with these New Age or visionary theories is that there's very, very little evidence to support them, except the people who are channeling them.
And what do you think of the credibility of the people in this category?
Well, I find it to be, on my credibility meter, down around 2 on a scale of 10, you know? And simply because, you know, most of us, we're all creatures of imagination, aren't we? We've all seen a lot of science fiction films, and most of us could produce material if we sat down and tried, could produce material that is similar to these channeled scenarios. So to me, this is the weakest category of the 9.
Are these people charlatans?
You know, that's a very good question. I think it would be harsh to say that. But they may be fooling themselves more than anybody else.
Okay, I know where you're coming from there. Ancient astronauts, category number 7.
Right. Well, of course, this is
one of my favorites.
Von Däniken, and all the spin-offs that have been generated by him. And the ancient astronauts theory is basically, you know, a cargo cult interpretation of alien contact. It sort of implies that all ancient religions were a worship of the gear and the hardware mm-hmm. that was left on Earth by extraterrestrials who came and visited and then mysteriously disappeared. So that's, you know, and to a certain extent, as I say it in the introduction to these theories, they overlap. So to a certain extent, you know, Sitchin also plays on the ancient astronaut idea. One of the things about this category is it tends to get very, very weird and tends to develop into what I call kind of crypto-fascism. So, for instance, the idea that Hitler escaped, you know, to South America in a flying saucer. the theory
donated,
the hollow,
donated by aliens, no doubt.
Donated right? by aliens, right. And the Hollow Earth fantasies and things like that. So this is a pretty mixed bag and gets into some very, very speculative areas and in my opinion, some rather unsound
Well, and areas. What's so unfortunate about that, too, is because I really believe that there were ancient astronauts, that we were visited before, and then when they throw in this hodgepodge of things like Hitler escaping to South America in a saucer, it kills the credibility of the entire theory.
It really does. That is what makes this category so problematical. And as you just pointed out, the latest scientific theories and the latest cosmological models support more and more the notion that we live in a multiverse. The discovery of Earth-like planets is now unfolding at a staggering rate. You know, I read sometime last year, during the time I was writing my book last year, that in 1 week they had discovered 100 Earth-like planets now. And we know that there are billions of stars in the universe capable of having planets like ours and capable of supporting life and supporting other civilizations. And so the evidence points to the high probability that Earth is an outpost for our species that has been visited by other civilizations. And it's really a shame that the crackpot element in the 7th category gets in the way of this more intelligent approach.
Yeah, it is. I keep thinking of the movie Contact, where in the midst of real science and the quest to find out just what was going on and where were these beings sending plans from, you had these people who were way out there, who were on the fringe, you know, when they were demonstrating and screaming and chanting. And they, I think, take away from the real good theories of what could be going on. You know, I think Von Däniken started with a great theory, and then it kind of got a little, as you say, crypto-fascism. It got a little too carried away.
That's right. That's right. It's hard to keep this story on track, though, you know, George, because the myth of contact with another species is such a powerful myth that it impacts the human mind in a very at a very deep level. And it's not always easy to keep our minds and our imaginations disciplined as we investigate this possibility.
In your opinion, are these visitors still coming back, or are they gone now?
Well, my views on the phenomenon have really been greatly affected by my deep immersion in this Nag Hammadi material over the last few years. And I am convinced of two things. First of all, that the human species, through our mind and our imagination, have the capacity to contact other parts of the universe and that and other dimensions, and that is part of the paranormal, and it is absolutely real, although we have to be disciplined about it. We can't do it in a crazy or reckless way. So I believe that all kinds of contact are possible to us. At the same time, I find a great deal of truth in the Nag Hammadi teachings, the Nag Hammadi material, which says that there is one particular predatory species that we really must look out for, and that is causing a great deal of trouble in our world.
David Icke would say that they are governmental leaders and officials throughout the planet, and they're able to shapeshift.
Well, that's really taking it very, very far down the line, but I will tell you that in the Nag Hammadi materials, they describe the Archons, that's their name for these entities, as having shape-shifting powers. And that is exactly the word that they use.
Interesting. Number eight, you call shamanic or indigenous?
Right, shamanic, indigenous evidence. This is a vast category. And basically, it covers all of the evidence that comes from traditional sources, like folklore of the American Indians. Most of the American Indian tribes, the Zuni, the Hopis, all speak in almost a routine manner of our connection with other dimensional beings, spiritual entities who are not human, as the Kachinas, for instance. It's been proposed by anthropologist Frank Waters that the Kachinas of the Hopis are actually a type of ET or non-human entity. Among the Aborigines of Australia, among the almost every culture in the world that you look into will give some evidence that we have contact. But again, I must qualify that in most of these cases, the indigenous peoples distinguish between a wide range of entities who are favorable to us and a few isolated entities who are predatory. So this is a vast body of evidence, and I cite some of the books there. Also, Jacques Vallee's book, Passage to Magonia, is kind of an inventory of a lot of this.
And another classic, too.
Right. One of the interesting examples in this category, George, is the tulpas, as they're called, that we encounter in Tibetan Buddhism. Now, here's a piece of evidence that is actually can be demonstrated today. I mean, there are people living today in Tibet, and there are Tibetan masters who can, it is said, produce a tulpa. And a tulpa is actually like a virtual reality phantom that would appear right in front of you. And we know that the technology of virtual reality is now getting close to being able to do this. I mean, we sort of imagine that, say, people 10 or 20 years from now, instead of watching television, might sit in their room and watch a virtual reality production.
Well, I'm convinced that one day, for example, radio will have a little me on everybody's desk, you know, doing this talk show.
That's right. That's right. A little, an avatar, as they call it.
Yeah.
A virtual reality, a replica of you speaking and appearing, just sitting there on the desk. Well, apparently,
probably a frightening thought to so many people. Huh?
We can always have a fly swatter on the desk, and you just swat the little thing, and it gets to be annoying, you know. apparently there are Tibetan masters who can produce these virtual reality images with their minds.
That's pretty powerful stuff.
Pretty powerful. And there are actual accounts of this. The most famous one, of course, is in the story Magic and Mystery in Tibet by Alexandra David Neal. She was a French woman, a European, who penetrated into Tibet in the beginning of the 20th century. And she tells this hilarious story about how she was studying with a Tibetan master who could produce these tulpas who were so real that a non-observant person couldn't distinguish them from a real human being. And that she produced, with the aid of her master, a tulpa. They were taking a pilgrimage into the depths of Tibet. And this tulpa joined the group and went trekking with them through the mountains. And the hitch was that her master did not tell her how to dissolve the tulpa. So it became kind of an annoying hanger-on until she learned the trick about how to reverse the process.
And off it went.
So there's a possibility then in this category that some types of alien contact are the result of this this tulpa phenomenon.
What if they're from another dimension or another multiverse?
Well, this is, I think, one of the great frontiers, and I sense that you're excited about this as well.
Yes.
I think this is one of the great frontiers of science now. You know, we're just reaching a point where science is beginning to admit that we live in a multidimensional universe. And so the next question would be, what is the key to opening the doors to those other dimensions? Now, I believe, and I bring this point up in my book because I deal with the ancient or indigenous wisdom of Europe, that people in ancient times, especially people in the traditions of shamanism, were able to do just that. You know, one way that you could define what is a shaman is it is a person, a man or woman, and there were many women shamans, who is able to pass freely from one dimension to another.
Mm-hmm.
One way that this is done is through lucid dreaming.
Sure, or mood-altering mushrooms or things
or
like
using, that. Or using mushrooms. The use of sacred plants or psychoactive plants, as far as I know, was common to all the great shamanic practices. So it was a tool. It wasn't used for intoxication or fantasy. It was a tool. Another word that comes up is bilocation. A shaman is someone who has mastered the ability to bilocate. And, of course, currently or recently, we've heard a lot about that in the works of Carlos Castaneda. Now, I know many people consider Castaneda to be a fraud, and they say that he invented Don Juan and all of that. And I have no argument with that. But when you look at the actual experiences that he described, they are consistent with traditional shamanic experiences. And Castaneda, as you know, vividly describes bilocation. A shaman is someone, just imagine this, who can be, you know, in two places at once. I mean, if I were an accomplished shaman, I could be here in this house in Spain, and I could be with you in the studio right there, not just on the telephone.
What a gift that would be.
That would be terrific. And this is no fantasy. There is a long-standing record that this is really possible. So if these, I think the exciting thing here, George, is that if we gain an understanding and an acceptance of a multidimensional world, then each and every one of us has to ask ourselves, you know, how can we enter in a sane and safe way into that experience?
Let's open up the phone lines with our guest John Lash when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.